Is it really hot right now where you are? Good time to ponder big questions about our warming planet, like the one our environment reporter sets out to answer today.
And that is how many super hot days we should expect going forward.
I'm Marco Werman. Also on the World Today, a court in the Netherlands holds the Dutch military partially responsible for a massacre in Bosnia 25 years ago. For victims' families, it's better than nothing.
At least we can see that there is somebody responsible, even 10%.
Plus, why engineers worried Neil Armstrong's first steps on the moon would not make it to TV screens.
They thought of everything. The one thing they could not control was the weather.
Australia's role in televising the moon landing. That story and more today here on The World. Dangerous heat today for many people across the U.S., including here in Boston. In fact, I was looking at a weather map earlier today, and much of the U.S. was shaded bright red or orange, with temps in the upper 90s in many places. That map also resembles the one for Western Europe right now. And then in the middle of this heat wave, we have this news to think about. Last month was the hottest June on record globally. That's according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The World's environment reporter, Carolyn Beeler, is here to talk about this with us. Carolyn, how you doing?
I'm all right. Hot, Marco. This temperature difference that made June the hottest on record ever might not sound like a lot. It was only about a degree and a half hotter than the global average. And that doesn't sound like that much, right? Like, can you tell if it's 72 or 73.5 degrees in the studio right now?
I cannot. Somewhere in there, probably. I think you're about right. Yeah.
Well, but there's another way to think about rising heat that really has stuck with me as a climate reporter. And that is how many super hot days we should expect going forward. So I want you to think about something with me.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, so think about 95 degrees.
All right.
You open the door to step outside and the heat just hits you like you're stepping into an oven. Whew. When you walk out on the street, you try to like find the spots of shade.
Ooh, tree.
You feel like you're hopping from air conditioner to air conditioner.
Air conditioning.
I remember very clearly June 2015 in New Orleans having that exact sensation.
Right. So 95 degrees we're talking about. Pretty hot. And here's the thing. We're going to see a lot more of those super hot days going forward.
Like how many days are we talking about?
Well, I want to look at one specific place to really make this concrete. Chicago. The U.S., when they were compiling their national climate assessment that was released last fall, they actually came up with projections for how hot Chicago is going to be going forward. And if you look at historical figures, roughly the last quarter of the last century, Chicago had about 3 days a year when the mercury rose above 95 degrees. And here is what that sounds like.
All right, that's our baseline.
So each of those nodes represents one 95-degree-plus day. Now, by the middle of this century, if we cut our carbon emissions pretty dramatically, this is how many 95-degree-plus days Chicago will get. That's 15 days per year above 95 degrees. But under a high-emission scenario, this is how many days of 95-degree-plus weather Chicago will get by mid-century. That's 22 days.
That is not encouraging.
And if we want to fast forward to around the end of the century under a high emission scenario, it gets a little crazy.
How many hot days was that?
49 days hotter than 95 degrees in Chicago. So you can imagine what that might sound like for much hotter places than Chicago, right? In Central America, in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia. But there's another takeaway here, which is that we still can do something about this because there's a big difference between that mid and high emission scenario. There's a big difference between this and this.
Yeah, big difference. The World's Carolyn Beeler starting us off today on a sweltering set of notes and some hopeful notes as well. Carolyn, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Sunday is election day, and one particular Asian country that gets a lot of press, but it probably won't get much coverage for this election because the outcome is already set. The country is North Korea. Its leader is a dictator, Kim Jong-un. So why is North Korea even bothering with elections? The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
That sounds a little like a football game. It's actually North Koreans cheering on Kim Jong-un as he prepares to do something you probably never pictured him doing, voting at his local polling station. Yep, North Koreans, they vote. Everyone from radish farmers to soldiers to the big man himself. In fact, there's an election this Sunday for provincial and city officials. Back in March, there was an even bigger election for the Supreme People's Assembly. That's a news anchor narrating as Kim Jong-un does his civic duty. First, he picks up his ballot, a little slip of paper presented to him on a fancy blue cloth. Then he just sticks it in a giant box without writing anything down and walks away. That's it. That's how everyone votes in North Korea, minus the fancy cloth.
When you get into the polling station, I mean, you get given a ballot paper. The ballot paper's got one name on it.
Glenn Ford is a British politician who has been to North Korea about 50 times, and he once got to see an election playing out in Pyongyang.
You go into a booth with a ballot box, and you're allowed to put your paper in unsullied, or there's a pencil there for you to cross it out.
For voters this Sunday, that is the only choice they'll have. Stick the pre-printed name in the box, or you could say, no, this candidate, presented by the tyrannical state that controls my entire life, no, hand me that pencil, I'm crossing out their name.
The theory is that if anyone gets rejected, you have another election the following week with a different name.
Does that ever happen? Ford says he asked, couldn't get a straight answer, so let's go with no. Also, voting is mandatory for everyone 17 and up. Expect 99% turnout because the only way you're exempted is if you're on a boat at sea. So what is the point of all this? Well, obviously, it's not a real election. Think of it more like a big patriotic party. At the polling station, there's lots of flag waving and singing and square dancing.
It's a day off and you don't get very many of those, and it's an opportunity to have a bit of fun and celebrate.
North Korean state media puts it like this. The voting ritual reinforces, quote, single-minded unity. It's not a battle of ideas. It's all about everyone coming together to think the same way. And that, according to the government, is preferable to capitalist countries where elections are, quote, just a competition between a tiny handful of wealthy and powerful persons.
It's probably considerably cheaper than the U.S. election, but I'm not sure saving money is the main consideration.
Ford says the fact that this process even exists in any form could be a good thing, because maybe in the future, if a local politician is really awful, North Korea might allow citizens to vote them out. Over in China, where the Communist Party also holds for or against elections, officials will sometimes let that happen.
So it's not impossible that at some point the Korean system may move in the same way. Certainly, I anticipate seeing a banner headline, 15% swing against the Workers' Party of Korea.
Yeah, any change to the system would be a crazy long shot. Assume that, this weekend, North Korea will keep on holding the most rigged elections in the world. But hey, there is one thing the North Koreans do have over the American system. At least their voters get the day off. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Today, the Netherlands Supreme Court ruled that the Dutch military was partly responsible for the Srebrenica massacre. Srebrenica was the worst atrocity in Europe since World War II. In July 1995, Bosnian Serb forces rounded up Muslim men and boys and killed more than 8,000 of them. The Dutch role in the massacre was that Dutch soldiers failed to defend the UN so-called safe zone of Srebrenica. The court said the Dutch state had 10% liability for the deaths. Amir Halevich is from Srebrenica, now resettled in London. His father was killed in the massacre in 1995. Halevich shared his reaction to the ruling today with the BBC.
Today is a very emotional day, but it is good to see that there is some judgment. And all these people that was killed, at least their families now, receive some sort of... but at least we can see that there is people there that helped on this, so there is somebody responsible, even 10%.
Dr. Waqar Azmi is chairman of Remembering Srebrenica. That's a nonprofit in Britain dedicated to keeping the memory of what happened in Srebrenica alive. Today's Supreme Court ruling, as you know, says the Dutch state bears the limited responsibility for the massacre, 10%. There was a previous ruling by a lower court that said 30%. What does that mean exactly?
What this means really is in terms of the 350 men and boys that they had expelled from their camp compound, that had they not expelled them, then they would have had 10% chance of surviving because the Serbs would have murdered them anyway. And that's what it actually means.
How did you react when you heard this news?
Well, we share the pain of the mothers. As an organization, we work with the survivors. We share the pain. We grieve with them in that we had hoped that the court would have, in terms of reducing the liability, would have held the Dutch government responsible. But we also acknowledge that it is a historical ruling in that a state has been found guilty for not protecting the people that they had promised in the UN safe haven, they had promised to protect.
What was the Dutch role at Srebrenica? What was their mission and what did they actually do?
Well, they were sent as part of the peacekeeping force in 1994 to Srebrenica, that UN peacekeeping force. Srebrenica was a safe haven where people fled from other areas to Srebrenica for safety because people were being ethnically cleansed in other areas. There were, you know, murders going on. So when they found out that the UN has declared Srebrenica town a safe haven, people, thousands of people fled from all across Bosnia-Herzegovina. The Dutch bats who were there from 1994 onwards were there to protect them. By 1995, 11th of July 1995, when Mladic, the force of Mladic overran the town, the Dutch bats did not fire even a single shot. And what it turns out is that they handed over people and the Mladic forces took young boys, men, bust them and took them to be murdered and they were put into mass graves.
Waqar Azmi, will there be any consequences for the Dutch soldiers who failed in protecting the safe zone?
I mean, I think I can't comment in terms of the Dutch soldiers. I mean, but what I can say is that the Dutch government needs to do two things. One is to look at the families and how they can support. You know, even away from the financial support, there is no psychological support. There's so much trauma that these mothers have gone through. The second thing the Dutch government can do is, like we do in Britain, and we're very proud to do that, to hold National Srebrenica Memorial Day to teach its own communities about the importance of building cohesion, about the importance of rejecting hatred and extremism, so that Srebrenica never happens again, so that hatred doesn't flourish.
Waqar Azmi with the nonprofit Remembering Srebrenica. Good to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
50 years ago, the world watched Neil Armstrong walk on the moon thanks to a gigantic radio telescope in Australia that was dealing with its own drama that day. That story still ahead here on The World.
The World is supported by ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. Turning on ExpressVPN protection only takes one click. Safely surf on public Wi-Fi without being snooped on or having your personal data stolen. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/theworld. That's expressvpn.com/theworld for 3 months free with a one-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/theworld to learn more.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It'll be 50 years tomorrow.
Thousands of technicians around the world have been working for many, many months to ensure that man's first landing on the moon will be the greatest show on Earth.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
It's thanks to Australia, by the way, that many of us got to see this historic moment on our television screens in 1969. But just before it all happened, engineers worried that they wouldn't have been able to pull it off.
They thought of everything. The one thing they could not control was the weather.
This is John Sarkisian. He's a scientist at Parkes Observatory in Australia. That's where the radio telescope with the strongest signal captured the moonwalk. But only just. It went like this, sort of.
What's happening?
Without power.
Control panel's dead.
Sorry, folks. Have it fixed in a jiffy.
Without a signal.
Let me get this straight. You've lost Apollo 11.
Without a clue.
How fictitious is that, John? I mean, most of it's real, right?
That part of the film was fictitious.
The film John's talking about there is The Dish. It's about the telescope in Parkes with the same name. The Australian movie came out in 2000. John advised the film crew about what went wrong that day.
On the day of the moonwalk, of all days, a violent squall hit the telescope. The dish was fully tipped over, waiting for the moon to rise. Minutes before Buzz Aldrin was to switch on the television camera, the squall hit with winds, very high winds, and in fact, it was subjected to two gusts of 110 kilometers an hour, which actually pushed the dish back against the zenith axis pinions, causing the tower that it's sitting on to shudder and sway. And the people inside in the control room, it created concern for them, as you'd imagine. Then just as Buzz Aldrin switched on the camera on the outside of the lunar module, as Armstrong was descending the ladder, the moon just moved in, just rose above our telescope's horizon, and the astronomers at Parkes were able to receive the television picture.
Wow.
It was quite remarkable. The timing was amazing. You couldn't script it better.
Something else I didn't realize, what we saw on our TV screens 50 years ago and what's played in history classrooms and on YouTube, it's not the original.
It's not what was directly transmitted from the moon. That's right.
The original magnetic tapes, the ones with the capacity to record that signal directly from the moon, those went missing.
So we went looking for them. And then unfortunately, about 12 or so years ago, we discovered that, in fact, in the late 1970s and early 80s, NASA had severe budget cuts. And so with new missions coming up, they needed data tapes to record the data from these new missions. And somebody remembered that all these Apollo-era tapes were in storage in the National Archives. They pulled them all, had them degaussed, erased, and recertified for use. And we believe that the Apollo 11 tapes were among those. There's no evidence to suggest they were treated any differently. So we unfortunately had to conclude that the original tapes were lost.
When the signal from the moon was received on Earth, it had to be converted into a format that you could see on TV. You know, the whole NTSC PAL nonconformity thing, remember that? That means the picture lost quality. We saw astronauts blurry with no stars in the sky. John and other scientists wanted so badly to retrieve the high-quality video, so they figured out a way to do that. He and his team reverse-engineered the raw moon signals into clear images. Before his death, Neil Armstrong thanked them for what he called a valuable contribution to space exploration.
One thing that he did mention was his surprise that when on the day of the moonwalk, both he and Buzz were actually surprised that a TV was actually received on the Earth.
Huh.
And in fact, you can hear that in the audio from at the beginning of the broadcast, because Neil says, you know, that you're receiving a picture now.
Roger.
And then Bruce McCandless, the Capcom, says, yes.
And we're getting a picture on the TV.
And then Buzz Aldrin says, is it a good picture?
Oh, you got a good picture, huh?
And then they say, yeah, it's a little dark.
There's a great deal of contrast in it.
But it's currently upside down, but they're getting the picture.
Monitor, but we can make out a fair amount of detail.
Detail's always better on radio. What can I tell you? John Sarkisian, operations scientist at Parkes Observatory in Australia, where the moon landing was transmitted for the whole world to see. The lunar lander touched down at 3:17 p.m. Houston time on Sunday, July 20th, 1969. It dominated the news. So we were curious what else was going on that summer. The world's history guy, Chris Wolf, has been digging.
You can't talk about 1969 without putting Vietnam front and center. 500,000 young Americans were in South Vietnam on the day of the moon landing. Their average age was 19. Nearly 12,000 Americans died there in 1969 alone, along with tens of thousands of Vietnamese. It was the story.
If there are any conclusions to be drawn from this pre-dawn attack, it's this: that the North Vietnamese are capable of coming through South Vietnamese lines like a sieve. Jim Bennett, ABC News.
Same-day news reports and graphic images on TV were shocking the nation. Protest songs like this provided the soundtrack for mass protests against the war, against the draft, against atrocities, against racism, against inequality, against the power of the man. For the new president, Richard Nixon, Vietnam was a top priority.
Tonight, I do not tell you that the war in Vietnam is the war to end wars, but I do say this. I have initiated a plan which will end this war.
He announced the plan just 5 days after Neil Armstrong took that giant leap for mankind. The Nixon doctrine amounted to letting the South Vietnamese take the brunt of the fighting. The drawdown of U.S. troops began immediately. But the war continued, and just a few months later, the draft for military service began using a lottery system.
The Draft Lottery, a live report on tonight's picking of the birth dates for the draft.
And America learned some sons were more fortunate than others. America was changing in other ways. The advent of the pill was revolutionizing sexual behavior, and recreational drug use was soaring. Timothy Leary, psychologist and advocate for psychedelic drugs, counseled the young on what they should be doing.
Having fun, being curious, exploring their sensual equipment, making love, trying to learn what it's all about.
Leary was the most dangerous man in America, according to President Nixon. But back to immediate news of that week, like Chappaquiddick.
This morning I entered a plea of guilty to the charge of leaving the scene of an accident.
Senator Ted Kennedy left behind at that scene a young campaign aide, Mary Jo Kopechne. She drowned in Kennedy's car off Chappaquiddick Island on Martha's Vineyard. Also that weekend, there was one spectacular achievement you've probably never heard of. John Fairfax became the first man to row across the Atlantic, or any ocean for that matter, battling storms and powerful currents in his little rowboat for 6 months.
I knew it was going to be very difficult. It was a lot harder than I thought, I must confess. But the main thing about me is that I never give up.
Sadly, Fairfax never got much publicity. He came ashore in Miami just the night before the moon landing. For the world, I'm Chris Wolfe. Oh, and there was Woodstock.
Some Muslims traveling to Saudi Arabia for the Hajj this year is complicated.
One part of me is saying, Eamon, you have to go. This is one of the most important rituals of your life. And the other part of me is saying, yo, the money that you're going to spend there might go to killing children. Like, how do I reconcile both of those two facts?
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. 25 years ago this week, a truck full of explosives blew up outside of a building in Buenos Aires, Argentina. That building was a Jewish community center. 85 people were killed and 300 more were injured. Today, a quarter century later, the U.S. government named a suspect in that bombing and drew a straight line to Hezbollah. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says Salman Rauf Salman was the mastermind of the Buenos Aires attack, a Hezbollah operative backed by Iran.
The State Department's Rewards for Justice program is offering up to $7 million for information leading to his identification or his arrest.
The government in Argentina also blames Iran and Hezbollah for that 1994 bombing. And this week, it designated Hezbollah as a terrorist group, the first Latin American country to do so. Natalia Cossoy is on the line from Buenos Aires, where he's been reporting on the story. So the bombing at the Amia Jewish Community Center was the biggest terrorist attack in Argentina's history. Take us back to what happened that day.
It was also considered one of the biggest in the whole region, I mean, in South America. I remember being a teenager and my mother waking me up in that morning. I was still sleeping because it was holidays time. I wasn't going to school, and she was crying, and we went rushed there to help. And it was quite very emotional for everyone.
So you were a kid and you went to the site of the bombing?
Yeah, we went to the site of the bombing. I was a teenager. Everyone tried to help, a volunteer, removing the rubble, trying to locate any survivors. And for Argentina, it's always been a big, big thing not being able to properly establish what's happened and properly taking to justice those responsible of this bombing.
So as far as the suspect Argentina is named in the bombing, he is Salman Rauf Salman. How did Argentina identify him? Did that come from the U.S. or did Argentina did its own intelligence work?
It's not quite clear how much is Argentina's own intelligence work and how much comes either from Israel intelligence services or the U.S. intelligence services when it comes to this case. In the justice, there are two cases being carried regarding to how much has been hidden during the investigation of this case. So whatever comes up, it's not yet super clear. As you said very precisely, it's the government who's saying that this man is linked to the bombing. It's not the justice system in Argentina has not yet decided or pointed to someone in particular. I mean, there are some people that are considered suspects, but the justice has not yet arrived to a conclusion, a definitive conclusion. And that's something that is exactly what the victims of the Amia bombing want and feel has not been achieved yet. And I think they feel it has not been achieved yet, not even with these announcements today.
Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, he's on an official mission to Argentina this week. Talk about the timing of this. I mean, 25 years after the bombing in Buenos Aires and now with Washington and Tehran in an escalating confrontation, is this announcement just a coincidence?
There seems to be something going on here in Argentina and the rest of Latin America with the visit of Secretary Pompeo here and to other countries after leaving Argentina in South America and Latin America, where he seems to be pushing forward for the countries to do something similar to what Argentina did in declaring Hezbollah a terrorist organization. So there seems to be an offensive, if you wish, from the State Department towards Hezbollah in the region.
Natalio Cossoy speaking with me there from Buenos Aires. The UK Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, said that Iran today had seized two ships in the Strait of Hormuz and called it unacceptable. President Trump addressed the situation as he was boarding a helicopter at the White House.
So we're going to be speaking with the UK, and this only goes to show what I'm saying about Iran. Trouble, nothing but trouble. And it goes to show you I was right about Iran. And let's see what happens.
All this is happening after yesterday's events in the same region when the U.S. claimed it shot down an Iranian drone. Iran says that did not happen. Barbara Slavin directs the Future of Iran initiative at the Atlantic Council. She says these latest events appear to be more of the same in the escalating tensions around Iran. I spoke with Slavin earlier about the different stories Iran and the U.S. have about that drone incident.
I mean, it's very, very hard for us to know who is telling the truth here. The Iranians have released some footage of what they claim was their drone doing surveillance over an American warship. Of course, that footage could have been taken before the drone was disabled. The Pentagon claims that it has disabled a drone, but they have not shown any footage yet, as far as I know, of the drone actually being destroyed or being brought down. So it's kind of a war of words right now.
Do you know how usual it is for Iran to fly a drone in that area?
Well, it's quite usual. I mean, this is the Persian Gulf, after all. And as Iranians are always quick to point out, it's the United States that's 6,000 miles away from home, not Iran. And of course, with tensions on the rise, the Iranians are concerned that the United States might attack some Iranian facilities, some Iranian base. And so I think they can argue quite persuasively that they're defending themselves against this kind of threat.
Just yesterday, Iran Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif told journalists in New York that Iran and the U.S. had been only a few minutes away from war after Iran shot down that U.S. drone last month. What does this latest drone incident say about where things stand? Is there any chance of things de-escalating?
Well, there's always a chance of things de-escalating, but, you know, obviously we're not on that path right now. It looks as though there are going to be more incidents like this in the Persian Gulf, hopefully without a loss of life, because I think that would be a real red line for either the United States or Iran, and it could lead to a wider conflict. But the Iranian foreign minister also put out a modest offer for a new deal, you know, suggesting that Iran might ratify something called the Additional Protocol, which allows intrusive inspections of Iran's nuclear infrastructure in return for lifting sanctions. So, you know, there are paths to de-escalation if the Trump administration is willing to take them.
So what do you think the two sides are thinking in terms of strategic options at this point and moving forward?
Well, the Iranians want desperately to get out from under sanctions. That's really all that they are concerned about at this point. The United States has declared economic war on Iran, putting a near total embargo on the Iranian export of oil, even though Iran was in compliance with the nuclear agreement it signed with the Obama administration and the international community. So Iran is responding. It's reacting to this pressure by putting pressure of its own on international shipping. You know, where it goes from here, I mean, the president says that he would be interested in new negotiations and talking to Iran, but there are real questions about whether other members of Trump's administration have the same desire for a deal or whether they're simply happy to watch Iran being squeezed.
How are the allies and other players involved in the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, taking all of this in? What is their perspective?
You know, they're very nervous. They're very, very worried, particularly the Europeans. The last thing they want to see is another war in the Middle East. Frankly, even U.S. allies in the region, like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, I think they're very happy with sanctions, but they also don't want a military confrontation because Iran would, of course, have an easy time hitting targets in those countries.
Barbara Slavin directs the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Thanks for being with us, Barbara.
It's my pleasure. Take care.
Next month, roughly 2 million Muslims will descend upon the holy city of Mecca for one of the most important rituals in Islam. Every Muslim must complete the Hajj at least once in their lifetime, as long as they are in good health and can afford it. The Hajj can only be done in one place, Saudi Arabia. But the kingdom's human rights record has left some Muslims conflicted about making the pilgrimage. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
Growing up in New Jersey, Ayman Smile loved the days leading up to the Hajj.
The teachers were awesome. They would make like a fake Kaaba, like a giant cardboard box. And all of us would go around it and be like, Labbaik Allahumma.
Kaaba, or the House of God, is the giant cube structure in Mecca, the holiest site in Islam.
You know, it was one of the things that we did every year in celebration of the Hajj. And it was a nice experience. Like, I think back to those times and I really couldn't wait to actually go.
For Ayman, just like for many Muslims, going on the Hajj would be a dream come true. It's a religious journey which Muslims believe cleanses their soul and brings them closer to God. So a while back, Ayman, who's 29, started to look into the logistics. He found that it would cost him about $10,000 to make the trip, with the flight, hotel, visa and all. Not cheap, but he was committed. So he started saving. By early last year, Ayman was well on his way to reach the $10,000 goal. His dream of performing the Hajj felt within reach.
It gets more expensive every year, and the longer you wait, the more expensive it gets. So I would love nothing more than just go, right?
Then things started to get complicated.
We've been with this gruesome new detail that a firm missing U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi is no longer alive.
Headline after headline described atrocities committed by the Saudi state. There was the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, the crackdown on activists, the Saudi war in Yemen. One news story out of Yemen struck a chord with Ayman. An airstrike on a school bus last year killed dozens of children. CNN obtained footage recorded by one of the boys on the bus just an hour before it was hit.
Less than an hour later, and most of the children you see in this video were dead.
That was a Saudi jet plane that fired that missile. I'm not comfortable with contributing to that.
Ayman has since been questioning whether he should go on the Hajj now.
One part of me is saying, Ayman, you have to go. This is one of the most important rituals of your life. And the other part of me is saying, yo, that money that you're going to pay for the visa or the money that you're going to spend there, all of that money is going to might go to killing children. Like, how do I reconcile both of those true facts?
Every year, when millions of Muslims from around the world go to Saudi Arabia for the pilgrimage, they also bring business. They stay at hotels, ride in taxis, eat in restaurants, shop for souvenirs.
So Hajj and Umrah, or religious tourism in general in Saudi Arabia, is a really important source of revenue.
Karen Young studies the political economy of the Gulf states at the American Enterprise Institute.
It makes up about 7% of total GDP in Saudi Arabia. So this is, you know, a pretty significant part of the economy.
She says oil revenues remain the largest contributor to Saudi economy, but the kingdom wants to reduce its dependence on oil. As part of that, she says, it plans to triple the number of pilgrims going to Saudi Arabia in the next decade.
The hope is that these pilgrims go on to become just tourists and visit other places within Saudi Arabia. So visa rules have been changed to both encourage people to extend their visits and also to charge them more, especially for repeat pilgrims.
About 20,000 Muslims from the U.S. are expected to go on the Hajj this year.
Okay, my first name is Zamir, which I wrote on the...
Zamir Sattar is the owner of Sara International Travel Agency in New York. His company offers various Hajj packages for about $9,000. Sattar says he hasn't seen any noticeable drop in the number of Muslim Americans booking with his agency.
No, not at all, not at all.
He says last year, when the news about Jamal Khashoggi broke, he was worried it might impact his business. But it didn't. Maybe it's because some Muslims have decided to separate the politics of Saudi Arabia from the country's religious significance. Yasser Ghadi is one of them. He's the dean of the Islamic Seminary of America. He's going to Saudi Arabia in 2 weeks, only because it's home to two of Islam's holiest sites.
Those sites are considered sacred by God, and politics changes, you know, kingdoms come and go, kings, you know, come and go and die and are born, and the sanctity of the place remains.
Ghadi has completed the Hajj 16 times in the past, often as a religious leader for tours. This year, he's leading a group of about 200 Americans. I mentioned Ayman Ismail's concern that by showing up in Saudi Arabia, by spending money there, Muslims could be indirectly complicit in the kingdom's human rights abuses.
Well, there's an element of truth to that, I must confess. But at the same time, we can flip it around. I'm an American citizen. I'm born and raised here. And I'm very, very thankful to God. And I am definitely thankful for having the experiences of this country. It's given me a lot. At the same time, I am highly critical of many aspects of the country I live in, especially its foreign policy. If that argument were to be flipped around and I would be told, why are you living in this land when your tax dollars are being spent, you know, on such and such? You know, the response to that is, well, an infinitesimally small amount of my personal tax dollars are going there. And overall, the benefit that comes for me to live here, for myself, my family, my faith, my people, my country, far outweighs the small percentage of money, you know, that my taxes might impact on what I disagree with.
So he says he's not only going this year, but he will continue to go. Recently, a high-ranking religious leader in Libya called for a boycott of the Hajj. But Ayman Ismail isn't advocating a boycott. He says this is a personal decision that every Muslim has to make for themselves. He says he's mad at the Saudi government for putting this doubt in his heart in the first place.
I really, really hope that one day, inshallah, the custodians of Mecca will empathize with the way that they've made Muslims feel around the world.
For now, he'll continue to save his money. He says he will participate in the Hajj one day. He's just not ready yet. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The notorious drug cartel leader Joaquin El Chapo Guzman is beginning his life sentence in prison this week. Meantime, his Sinaloa drug cartel has moved on from trafficking cocaine and heroin to a new drug of choice, fentanyl. It's a synthetic opioid that's 50 times stronger than heroin and blamed for tens of thousands of overdose fatalities each year in the U.S. Most fentanyl originates in China, but increasingly the drug's chemical components are shipped to Mexico first, where cartel labs turn it into fentanyl and then move it into the United States. Scott Stewart with the research group Stratfor has been looking into why cartels are turning to this deadly drug. Scott, fentanyl is such a dangerous and fatal piece of the opioid crisis here in the U.S. Right now, as of July 2019, where is it coming from? Which countries?
We're seeing some fentanyl sent directly from China to the U.S., primarily in the flow of commerce, you know, stuff that's being purchased on the dark web, where we'll have fairly pure fentanyl sent by mail to dealers who will then cut it into either fake narcotic pills or they will cut it into fake heroin. But then also we have organized crime groups that are trafficking it into the country through Mexico. And then we also see some of it coming in through Canada from Asian organized crime groups.
So with fentanyl coming to the U.S. via Mexico, what's happening to it in Mexico before it gets brought into the U.S.?
Well, we're kind of seeing two sources there. Some of it's coming in directly from China that's already made, you know, manufactured. But then we're also seeing the precursor chemicals come into Mexico. And then the Mexican cartels are, you know, synthesizing fentanyl in their labs. It's actually an easier drug to synthesize than methamphetamine. So these Mexican super labs are pretty well positioned, both in terms of their supply chain to China, but also their ability to synthesize the drug due to their experience in the methamphetamine trade.
Trace the route for us for fentanyl as it leaves Mexico and comes to the U.S. How does it get here? Who's delivering it and who's it delivered to?
Yeah, what we're seeing is they're pretty much piggybacking onto the infrastructure that they've established and long had established for other drugs coming into the U.S. So we're seeing especially the synthetic drug organizations such as, you know, Sinaloa are kind of using a lot of the same labs and infrastructure to smuggle the drugs into the U.S. that they've used for methamphetamine. But also we see a lot of parallel into the Mexican cartels that have really cornered the heroin market in the United States. And so we're seeing fentanyl being also pushed in that same supply chain up into the U.S. and then down to street distributors.
What makes fentanyl, do you think, the drug of interest currently for Mexican cartels?
Yeah, there are really several factors that make it really an ideal drug for these organized crime groups. One is that it's cheap to produce. We're seeing estimates coming in from DEA that it costs between $1,400 to $3,000 a kilo to produce. Of course, they can then turn around and sell that retail for over $1 million on the street.
And how does that compare to heroin, for example?
It's much more lucrative. Mm. So really, essentially, smuggling 1 kilogram of fentanyl is roughly the equivalent of smuggling 50 kilograms of heroin into the U.S.
What are the other reasons Mexican cartels seem to like this?
It doesn't have a growing season like opium poppies do. You don't need a lot of land to cultivate it like you do opium poppies. And basically, you can fabricate it or synthesize it any place that you have the chemicals available. It's also compact to smuggle. You know, it's lucrative, compact, easy to make, easy to smuggle. It really is a dream drug for Mexican organized crime.
So which country do you think is the bigger threat at this point in terms of fentanyl flooding the U.S., China or Mexico?
It's really a combination of all of the above. I think that like the methamphetamine trade, you know, everything goes back to these precursor chemicals that are predominantly coming out of China. But certainly the Mexicans then have the ability to really crank out and then smuggle huge quantities of this drug. You know, I don't want to downplay kind of the mail order dark web model. It is resulting in deaths. And certainly, you know, just a few grams or an ounce of fentanyl that is very pure coming in from China can kill a lot of people. But we compare that to these shipments of 100 kilos or 70 kilos that we're seeing coming in from Mexico. And we can see that the Mexicans are really flooding the market with fentanyl in a way that the Chinese can't do directly by mail.
Why do the precursor chemicals for fentanyl come solely, it seems, from China?
Well, I think a lot of that just goes back to the difficulty of controlling all these factories and the number of them that there are in China.
You spend a lot of your time researching and writing about drug cartels and the opioid epidemic in the U.S. What keeps you up at night, Scott? What are you most worried about?
As I've been looking more closely at fentanyl lately, I really believe that there's a misunderstanding out there across the world that sees fentanyl as being a North American problem. It's basically just an issue for the Americans or the Americans and Canadians to deal with. But I believe that the very same factors that make fentanyl attractive for the Mexican cartels also make it attractive for other organized crime groups across the globe that are involved in the illicit opiate trades. So Balkan organized crime groups, Russian organized crime groups, even organized crime groups that are selling things like counterfeit tramadol across the Middle East and Africa.
What is that product you just described, that drug?
Tramadol is actually an opiate pill. So it's weaker, but somewhat similar to, you know, our oxycodone that we've seen in the U.S. And I believe that it's going to be a similar gateway drug for illicit fentanyl pills, the same way that we saw illicit fentanyl pills coming in for the Oxycontin, oxycodone in the United States.
Scott Stewart, an expert on terrorism and security issues with Stratfor. Scott, really appreciate your time on this. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We close today with one more nod to the moon. And this song, released this week by an Italian we featured on the show a few times, Jovanotti.
E guardo il mondo da un oblò, mi annoio un po', passo le notti a camminare dentro un metro e sembro uscito da un romanzo giallo, ma cambierò.
This is actually Jovanotti's cover of the pop classic Luna by Gianni Togni, a huge hit in Italy when it came out in 1980, a love song in which the object of the singer's affection is a woman named Luna, or was Togni singing about the moon itself? Anyway, with Jovanotti's version, the intent is clear. He released this cover of Luna to celebrate tomorrow's 50th anniversary of the moon landing. Just another reminder that Apollo 11 captured the entire world's imagination and united people, even for a brief moment. Guardo il mondo da un oblò. I look at the world from a porthole. Sometime tonight, grab a few moments to turn your eyes to the waning moon and just contemplate. That's where we leave you today. Our theme music was composed by Ned Porter. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH. Have a great weekend and use your head in this heat. Keep cool.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.